u11 is a function of non-commuting coordinate small x, etc. And clearly, it satisfies this relation. Okay, so why is there a non-commutative gate symmetry? Now, this is very simple to explain if you look at the following. Suppose you rotate this matrix capital X, say. So what will happen is that you will rotate this background and you rotate this part of the gate. What you do is you add and subtract this background again. And you can understand this term essentially as the longitudinal piece of the gauge transmission for the following reason. It is well known that given an algebra like this, one can define the notion of a derivative or a translation operator on this algebra, and that is just given by this formula. It is basically theta inverse times the adjoint action of so immediately you can see that this term basically here can be written essentially as this term. And therefore, when the x's rotate sort of globally, the gauge transmission, the gauge beam undergoes a normal gauge transmission of the non-commutative gauge theory. So I think this stuff doesn't like me.
Maybe if you put it in your pocket.
Okay. And these fields transform essentially as that. Okay. So if you substitute this expansion for the matrix model matrices written as expansions around a certain background, then one obtains a Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian of the non-commutative gauge theory. So this is just a matter of substitution, and we expect all this to come out for reasons which I have explained, that this curly A in fact actually transforms like a gauge field. If you look at the matrix model Gauss law, that also nicely turns into the Gauss law of the non-commutative gauge theory. These dots over here indicate fermionic terms which I have sort of omitted. Stop. And here you have the covariant derivative and the open string metric, which in our case is a very simple, is a very simple form. Okay, so this is how the non-commutative gauge theory arises from the matrix model. Okay, so now let me spell out how to describe a brain anti-brain system in the context of the gauge theory. This is also sort of well known in the literature. What you do is that you consider the following static solution of the non-commutative gauge theory. You just take the gauge field A1 and write it as almost zero everywhere, except you put in some flux in this place over here, and if you calculate the field strength, it just basically is a constant magnetic field with value minus 2 over theta in the 1-2 plane. So let's just do that. Let's look at this classical solution. And if you look at this classical solution and rediscuss or rewrite the original matrix model matrices or operators, then they basically look like this, x1, x1, and x2, and minus x2. And it's well known that if you turn on this flux, there is a orientation reversal of this coordinate, and this is the the D2D2 bar system. So the D2D2 bar system can be understood essentially as a classical solution of the non-commutative gauge theory.
Are they separated, or are they sort of supposed to be a little on top of each other?
They're on top of each other for this talk. I forgot to say that.
Okay.
You can actually also discuss the problem separated by some distance r, as has been done by Aharon and Berkus, but for this talk, they are sort of sitting on top of each other.
And there's a static solution where they just sit on top of each other?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And this is the solution. This is the solution of the equation solution. Of the matrix model, some mistake.
No, it's just classical solution of the decay of mechanics.
Yes, that is the whole purpose of this talk.
Remind me how you see the universal orientation from your the way you set it up.
Yes. You see, if you look at this formula, let's say x1 actually, or okay, so x1, so it's 1, 2 over here. So the gauge field over here is a2. On the other hand, if you take x2, then the gauge field over here is minus a1, and a1 has this fellow sitting over here. So it comes with a minus sign. So when you add plus x2 upon theta, you just get this. So, all right. So now, having said this, I want to sort of switch gears slightly and forget about which background I'm working with, and develop gauge theory in a way which will help me study the extraction of the tachyon potential, which is imminent because, as we know, this configuration, this classical solution is unstable, and we expect to have a tachyon if we perturb this theory around that configuration. But for the moment, let me discuss this theory independent of what background. So we could as well be working with D2D2 system or D2D2. So let's write the non-commutative gauge field, turning A, as essentially a 2x2 matrix of operators. Okay. So these are Hermitian operators, and these are complex operators, and small matrix values 1 and 2. And you calculate the field strength of this with this parameterization, and the field strength essentially like this. Okay. I mean, this is a very elementary calculation, just to be familiar with doing these calculations in gauge theories, and this detail goes true for the non-commutative gauge theories. Now, the point is that, the important point is that this object transforms in the adjoint representation of the non-commutative gauge group. So I can use this field strength to fix a gauge. I use it to fix a gauge which basically sets the off-diagonal terms of the field strength to 0. And these terms set equal to 0. Now, you might ask about whether it is possible to go to this gauge. So the attitude to take over here is not to think of operators in terms of large n by n matrices. Then obviously it goes to, and then hope that as n goes to infinity, when you treat all these objects as operators in a Hilbert space, it should go through also. So that is the only little assumption which goes into most of my talk. So we choose this gauge and its Hermitian conjugate. So once you fix this gauge, the U2 symmetry is realized only as in this gauge as a U1 cross U1 symmetry. That's sort of obvious. And this A and H will transform as gauge fields of this U1 and this U1 respectively. But this
U infinity, so one, what that, really is unitary transformation, so no.
And this.
So, you know, in particular, it's very non-commutative.
Pardon?
In particular, it's not like U1, it's non-commutative.
Yes, yes, it's actually infinite dimension. So, the TA basically transforms as a matter field in this gauge, which has U1 cross U1 transformation properties on the left and right. Okay. And now, you may want to extract the static Hamiltonian and the potential. This is particularly easy to do because the difficult part will be the time-dependent, rewriting the electric field terms of the Hamiltonian in terms of independent coordinates. But we are interested for our purposes only in the potential or the static Hamiltonian, and that is not very difficult to extract in practice, just given by these formulas. So. Okay, so it's given by epsilon naught times the small, this small trace essentially is an infinite dimensional trace of H1 and H2 square, and H1 and H2 are essentially given by the top part, one U1, the top part of the field strength, the big field strength, and the what I mean is basically these two pieces. Now, in this this model, of course, is a very well defined group theory. So you can say immediately what is the exact ground state. This is the supersymmetric minimum in which. H1 and H2 are simply set equal to 0, and that corresponds to, in fact, X1 commutator X2 in the matrix model language to be equal to 0. So you can actually now, find out, calculate the value of this static Hamiltonian, for example, for the D2, D2 bar system. You take this configuration, just plug it in, and you get the sums. And this trace of 1 essentially is n.
When you get epsilon 0 is what?
Epsilon 0 is basically proportion to theta squared divided by the string coupling.
Trace of 1 is infinity, right? And is that saying that's the volume?
That's right. So I will consider intensive quantities usually if I want to calculate. String tension is a good thing to consider here.
But when you, is that why you put the regularization? I mean, how do you know it's the volume and not twice the volume?
Okay. I think. The working rule is basically this one.
That's the volume.
If I go to the star product language, you divide by a transform. This is the working rule which I'm working with. And this is. Sorry. So you can extract the potential energy actually from this static Hamiltonian. You just it's defined by a constant shift. And the important point over here is that in fact this potential energy can be written as an integral over some local object, some translational invariant of potential energy density. Here, of course, I have actually used the Weyl-Mayol correspondence to write the operator equations in terms of ordinary functions, but the multiplication is in terms of the star product. Of course, this is all
very well known, so I didn't want to detail it, but I thought just half a minute for completeness of what this correspondence is. This correspondence basically is a connection between operators in Hilbert space and Fourier transforms of functions, let's say in the plane, where it is easy to do this correspondence. And here there is a very basic operator, which is the element of the Heisenberg Wild group, which satisfies the multiplication law. This is a very famous multiplication law. And the implication of this multiplication law is that if you multiply two operators, then the corresponding functions get star multiplied, that's all. So it's an extremely elementary exercise, and this is the essence of it, basically. Now what I would like to do for the next couple of transparencies is to extract, in principle, a formula for the potential of a static Hamiltonian in terms of the independent degrees of freedom of this model, an exact formula. Later on, I will sort of show you how that formula can be used in order to arrive at configurations which interpolate between the unstable point and the exact supersymmetric ground state. Okay. Now, in order to proceed further, you have to fix further gauge, because there is this gauge symmetry, and the most natural thing to do is to fix some sort of a background field gauge. I think this is essentially the gauge which was mentioned in the calculation of Haram-Yupakus, though they can do it in the gauge theory language. It's essentially the background field gauge, which eliminates gauge zero modes. And it's a translation invariant choice of gauge. However, this gauge condition is, there are two problems with it. First is that it is very hard to solve this gauge condition for independent degrees of freedom, so it is good for us when we do perturbation theory. So we choose a slightly different type of gauge. We choose an axial gauge. And this is the axial gauge choice. This is not a background solution anymore, but this is a choice of gauge, and you can actually show that it is always possible to choose this gauge, again by appealing to the fact that operators in Hilbert space can be approximated by large matrices. Okay. And in this gauge, you can actually exhibit the independent degrees of freedom. Now, before I go on to doing generalities, let me sort of, you know, try to convince you that what things look like in this gauge. So take, for example, the D2-D2 configuration, that is, just two D2 grains on top of each other. Such a configuration, we know, is basically given by the background. That is this background. We talked about before. X1 is equal to just this. X1, X2, X2, X2. Plus nothing, plus zero. So that is what this is. The gauge field is zero. Now make a unitary transformation. This is the unitary transformation. Operator transformation. Or you can do also in the C-star language. And then you will see that this trivial configuration can be actually gauge transformed into this gauge. But then you develop A2 drift also, so that the flux is maintained to be zero. So you can do this elementary exercises. You can take, for example, the vacuum configuration, which one particular vacuum configuration is this. And you can also make a gauge transformation of the type I have indicated, so that the corresponding vacuum configuration is again in this case. So, you know, it is actually possible to do these things by hand. I mean, it's not just a formal. Okay. So now, the main point is that we have to look at the intersection of these two gauge slices, namely the axial gauge and the unitary gauge. And the good point about this gauge is the fact that the covariant derivative, the operator covariant derivative d1 t2, you can just work this out. It becomes very, very simple. Now let me make one point that we have not been able to solve this problem in the operator language, but you can do it in this if you go to star product and work in terms of functions, and this is the result actually. So if you look at this equation, then this equation immediately solves for t2 in terms of t1, a2 and a2 t2. And you might be worried about the singularity over here. You can regulate it, but in actual practice, when you do the calculations, you find that these configurations are such that this singularity doesn't really take. So therefore, the independent degrees of freedom are.
There's an order in question.
Pardon?
Wait. The one number x2 and the number.
No, this is C number. This is in the star product notation. So as I.
How are you multiplying the x2 to the
what?
Right, no, right.
Pardon?
Just start between one of our x2 and the parentheses.
It's a regular multiplication.
No.
Yeah, right?
No, this is simply ordinary multiplication.
No, the green line. You start
the green line over here.
Between the first factor and the second factor.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you see, I mean, I took this fellow, which is x2, 2i x2 times t2 is equal to this.
So I see, so you're using both multiplications?
Yes.
For the same function?
Yes.
So you really don't mean a star, you really mean
yes,
no
yes.
Star.
So this is just ordinary 1 upon x2, C number, times this object over here. And this identity is of course, you can see why it works because there's a linear x2 over here and there's a t2 star x2. So there's a derivative that comes from here. It simply cancels this. And then there's just ordinary multiplication. Fine. So this is... but as you will see that as I do the computation for the configurations which go from the unstable point to the stable vacuum, I will be doing all this really. I mean, for specific ansatz for the functions T, A, and A2. Okay, so this is what I was saying, that the static Hamiltonian can be written as a closed formula for the in terms of the independent degrees of freedom. And this static Hamiltonian, of course, is consistent also with Gauss's law. Now, if you try to rewrite the full Hamiltonian, that is the kinetic piece of the Hamiltonian, also in terms of the independent degrees of freedom, which is something which we did not attempt, it is obviously very complicated. We know that. But for static problems, this is not necessary. Okay. So now, let us try to study this problem and a little bit case by case. Let us now look for classical solutions, classical configurations, which are extrema of the static Hamiltonian. So let's take the first case. The first case is simply given by. Let's take the following ansatz. This is just the projection onto the vacuum. I am now assuming a harmonic oscillator basis as is standard in this subject. And I have written out this ansatz. And this is a complex number which can be time dependent, and it is in fact, as I will show you what the time dependence over here is. And these are also quantum mechanical time dependent objects, but they are real. So we know that P0 essentially in the Weyl-Mayer transform goes into this Gaussian, which is the spread is basically square root of theta. So now let us work out the static Hamiltonian in this particular subspace. We just do the calculation. And what I'm saying is basically now you have to solve the gauge conditions and everything once more. You do get T3 equal to I T times V0. This notorious 1 upon X2 cancels out, and you get a very simple formula for the static Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, you may want to consider the time dependence also for this very simple mode. You can do all the calculations. And the full time dependence is given over here. And this is essentially the formula which was derived by Aharoni and Berthus some time ago in the in their discussion of this problem. And so you see that there is a instability as expected, and the mass associated with that is just given by minus 2 times theta. And as I mentioned in the beginning, theta in the matrix model has to be identified with 1 upon small b, which is the requires dp. So it just works out exactly as you expected. And in fact, if you substitute this ansatz in the Gauss law equation, you find that the phase of t in fact turns out to be time independent. And now you can minimize this Hamiltonian. You can look for the minima of this Hamiltonian, and they just correspond to mod t square equal to 1 upon theta. And the A, the coefficient of the gauge field, is equal to 0. And you can calculate now the static Hamiltonian again. And it turns out to be it turns out to be 2 less than the static Hamiltonian, which was there on top of the potential. So this particular classical solution actually removed some energy from the brain anti-brain system. So now you can give a rather nice suggestive picture of what's going on here. So for that, let's introduce some definitions. In the unitary gauge, this curly F12, which is the full field strength of the U2 non-commutative gauge theory, just I'm defining this as F plus 1, 2 and F minus 1, 2. These are the formulae for curly F plus and curly F minus. And let us define a flux, small f plus, as minus trace of this, and small f minus as minus trace of this. And let us try to see what the values of this fluxes are for the various configurations of interest. So for example, the first thing you do is you calculate it for the V2, V2 bar system. Clearly, this is 0, and as we know, this flux is just 2 upon theta times n. You can normalize these flux, but I have not done that basically. You calculate for the vacuum, and you find essentially F plus and F minus are equal, and they are given essentially by these numbers. And you note one fact that if you add these two for both these cases, you get the same answer as expected. So this is the flux corresponding to one U1, and this is the other U1. Now, let us look at our classical solution actually. So for our classical solution, which was solved by these configurations, I have explicitly introduced the value of, absolute value of t at the classical solution, at the minimum of this, at the minimum of the static Hamiltonian evaluated in this one-dimensional subspace. And you can do this calculation and convince yourself, it's very easy, that small n plus is 1 upon theta and small n minus is minus 1 upon theta plus the background value. So this is the picture then. So what you have, just imagine V2, V2 bar system on top of each other, but there's a plus 1 flux over here, and there's a minus 1 flux over here. And this, the shaded line represents this background that which may be the V2, V2 bar system. We also noted that minus 2 units were subtracted off from the Hamiltonian, and they are simply the contribution to the energy given by these two fluxes. And in fact, this picture is quite nice because you know that in the Noyal-Weyl correspondence, the projection operator P0 over here is just a Gaussian, and so you have a pore size of square root of theta over here. Okay, so this is a pictorial way of saying what's sort of going on over here in this one-dimensional subspace. But now actually what we would like to do is look at what I call a multi-vortex solution actually. So one can really construct this, and I just want to present this construction to you. So let us look at the multi-vortex solution now specified by an integer, by a positive integer, small n. So you write an ansatz again, where tj's are some complex numbers, and tj's are these projection operators. And an a triple also is written by this. It is instructive to note that in the Weyl-Noyal formula, this operator t over here is actually this function, which is expanded in terms of the Laguerre functions and this Gaussian. And we saw previously that when we looked at the single vortex, only this particular piece was contributing. And now you want to solve the unitary gauge condition, etc., etc. You want to do the whole works for this particular ansatz for the n vortex solution. First thing that you find is that T2 can again be solved within this subspace by this formula. You don't encounter any 1 upon x2 singularities or anything. And this omega j's turn out to be given by these formulas. So this is a solution of gauge condition. That is, omegas are given in terms of the t's, which appear in the original ansatz as a solution of the gauge condition actually. So it's still off shell, okay, that's the point. Then the static Hamiltonian potential can also be calculated within this subspace. Okay. And it turns out to be this type of formula. It's not very complicated really. Just looks complicated. So you can again define the potential energy. And now you can talk of minimizing, looking at the extrema of this Hamiltonian by varying the parameters t's, because the w's are functions of t's. And after a straightforward calculation, what you find is that the t's redefined as ours actually satisfy this set of equations actually. And you can prove that this set of equations always has a solution actually. So I explicitly can solve all these things to get a solution. And then you calculate the static Hamiltonian again. And it turns out to be twice capital N, which was the value of the static Hamiltonian on the top, potential, minus twice small n. So what's going on is that the n-vortex solution exactly cancels small 2n or the total 2n units of energy of the brain and the brain system. So obviously if small n is equal to capital N, then all the energy will be cancelled actually by that configuration. So it is indeed possible to build a configuration that takes you to the bottom of the potential explicitly as a solution of the equations of motion.
Wait, now I'm getting a little confused. Yeah. So these solutions are the same as what you get by conjugating by a partial isometric. These solutions are the same as what you get by conjugating the vacuum by a partial isometric. No, the shift operator to the nth power.
I don't know that.
They look awfully similar. Okay. Let's suppose that's right.
But the coefficients have to match correctly in order for that to happen.
Okay.
So I don't know. But I haven't thought about
it. If that's right.
If that's
then
right.
Then my real question comes. Because you're about to tell us you want to take little n equals big N?
Yes.
But then the shift operator to the infinite power. Zero.
But I didn't say yes to what you said first. So okay, we can discuss this. Are you saying that this is some sort of coherent state?
Well, which is the ill-defined limit?
I'm a little confused. Big N is really infinity.
Okay.
And by taking little n to be equal to big N.
Yes.
I'm wondering if this is.
If there's some mathematical.
Well, I'm a little confused.
Okay. No, I mean, these things can be subtle, and we can discuss it. May I proceed?
At the very least, there's an ordering question. An order of limits question.
Where is the ordering question?
The order of limits question would be whether you take big N to infinity and then little n to infinity, and then how fast.
My attitude is to use large N as a regulator. See, otherwise, I don't know how to do this. I'm good. Okay.
Roughly speaking, the big N is the ball in the space, the small n is the vortex, but vortex have size, so you can't fit more than the ball in that is being regulated.
Yes.
That's what, right?
Yes, essentially. That's So in fact, this is this picture. So if you calculate the flux of this solution, this picture is actually not a good picture because in fact it's possible to construct a very nice picture by plotting the Laguerre function. So what really happens is that as you go to larger and larger n, the profile of the solution, which was Gaussian for one vortex, actually starts looking like this. Or like this, with lots of wiggles in between. But the largest power actually goes, has a maximum that eats up the entire flux, actually, basically. So this is just a schematic way of drawing it. So then, this verifies in some very simple-minded model and way what Sochen conjecture. I mean, this conjecture is very useful when you don't know the potential, you see. And you're trying to extract all these things. But when you know the potential so explicitly, it's very easy to see that.
So, of course, here you're left with a collection of these zero rings that the
exactly.
can end on.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So this is not the the vacuum which most people are interested in today. It's not that. Fine. Okay, so this is just a slight elaboration on what I mentioned to you. In pictures, then if you actually now calculate the x1, x2 commutator, substituting all these configurations, and the top of the potential, it is this one. This is the brain and the brain system. The bottom of the potential is this. This is the supersymmetric vacuum. And what I have been trying to tell you is this, what I forgot to put a zero. So this is how the X1, X2 matrices basically look like. Now, all this connection with, we have discussed some connection with closed string theory in our paper, but I'm not going to discuss that over here because I don't understand all those things too well, and I have to study Joe's paper very, very carefully to be able to extend the matrix model to include the higher excitations of the string theory. Here we have simply looked at the lowest lying modes, and this is a good model for that as D0 brain quantum mechanics. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? No? Let's thank Spencer again.
That is what makes it work. Because D is very large, small, D theta is very small, the potential is very shallow actually in this problem. So all this technology works for that case.
So you're saying that this is exact?
Yeah, certainly. But if D is on a 1, then of course, I mean, at least not at present.
I am under the altitude. Can you make the D2 ring on other D2 ring?
Yes.
As separate?
Yes, certainly.
Is that easy potential?
That is actually, the calculation is much more complicated actually. That calculation was done by Aharon and Berkus in the matrix model.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more involved actually. But for our purposes, it was not necessary to do that. So there is another parameter then.
Yeah, sure.
There's another parameter.
Yes, if the vacuum is very large, then the vacuum becomes massive.
Yes.
So, there is another application for this system, which is done by Bono production.
I know that. No, I am sorry.
If you consider the some solution of Bono production, which is non-supersymmetric, then you can evaluate the potential of that system.
Yes.
Actually, between these two domains. So you can compare your result to that calculation and you can evaluate what is correct. I think that's a nice way to check this.
I see.
My name is Cole Jasper.
My name is the solution was discussed with my so you're not the fourth person. I was in the pump.
two successors here. He was there. How long have you been there?
Well, I've been there for almost 2 decades.
Well, you've been around. But wait a minute. It's very funny. I'm in the 80.
No, I was not there. Yeah. No, I am 82.
So, who is there now in the Ramakrishna place? Maybe you?
No, no. I'm in I'm theoretical physics school actually. So I'm a string theorist. That's a different group. Astrophysics group actually. So apparently, I don't. I mean, it's hard to replace now. So,
he's in
Trey was there, right? Yeah.
He's doing much besides writing books.
No, not Trey.
Oh, by the way, I like very much a copy of the paper.
Okay. Yes, I have one. I can give it to you right now.
How long are you staying here?
I've been here for 2 weeks actually, so I'm out of the return on.
Skanta,
yes.
Jackie wants to give me a present. So you're going to still be here tomorrow, right?
Yes.
So is there sometimes you can buy and catch up?
Yes. I mean, that's.
I'm going to talk, but sometimes you're here over here. Yes. I'm not trying to make an appointment.
Never.
How many months have you been talking about? For her. But you're the U.S.
Yeah,
I sent
you a
picture
today, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm so busy.
But you said
I'm
thinking about,
yeah, having a trench
truck.
Right? But I want to talk to you about your thing.
Yes.
Can we do that later today?
Yes. What time?
You're going to maybe have to go get here.
I'm just. I will have my lunch actually and then I'll come back.
So,
okay, so after cookies means around 3 to 4.
Okay,
I'll see you.
Okay. Here with you. Well, give my regards to the old people, the family, must be going. Were you in contact with mathematicians a lot?
Yes, that's right. The dot X.
Okay, that's fine. That's very interesting. I thought it was very well presented. Understandable. About the outfit itself. Where did you go from the outfit?
Heisenberg algebra.
Oh, you might just ask
Heisenberg. H is Heisenberg.
Yeah. Yeah. Selected.
No, no, I was just the Heisenberg algebra. Yeah.
All right. Very well presented. Thank you. You had very few questions.
Yes,
thank you very much.